New Centre at 6. The government's ordered an independent review into building regulations after 82 tower blocks failed new rigorous safety checks. The tests were ordered in the wake of the Grenfell fire disaster in which at least 80 people died. Cladding was widely blamed for spreading the fire quickly up the building. The Shadow Housing Minister, John Healey, says actions needed immediately.
I don't want anybody hiding behind a cloak of secrecy or dragging their feet on the work that needs to be done to make these buildings safe. The second thing that must happen is that government has got to be much clearer, much firmer, and give more confidence that they will help with the costs.
North Korea has fired a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan. Officials say it flew for 45 minutes before landing. The Pentagon is investigating. Dr. Patricia Lewis from the international affairs think tank Chatham House says bigger powers need to step in.
China and Russia recently announced that they would have a joint approach to North Korea. But I think things are getting so hot that they need to step in quite quickly. And probably the whole Security Council needs to get together now and send a very forceful, powerful message.
London and Dublin can't agree on how a post-Brexit border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland could work. The Irish Prime Minister says he's opposed to an economic barrier and won't help the UK design one for those planning the EU departure. Passengers from most of Turkey's airports will now be able to carry large electronic devices in aircraft cabins on inbound flights to the UK. Restrictions will remain on five other countries over continuing security fears. That's the latest.
Now, the vast majority of the American people think that the Federal Reserve System is a United States government-owned agency. That is positively false. All of the stock of the Federal Reserve banks is owned by the member banks, and the heads of the member banks are all members of the hierarchy of the great Illuminati conspiracy known today as the CFR.
Welcome back to PCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Could Zionist threats to demolish the third most holy mosque in Islam set off a wider Middle East, even a world war? In Hebrew, it's called the Tisha B'Av, Israel's annual national mourning, this weekend for the second destruction of the Jerusalem Temple around 43 AD. Around about the same time, the Romans invaded Britain. The temple was originally built by Solomon around 975 BC and spending the last two-thirds of its history as a flat piece of stone. Now the Zionists are back in charge in occupied Jerusalem. They intend to rebuild what they see, or at least some of them do, as their temple. And why not? Only one problem, a third most holy site in Islam, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is in the way and may have to be demolished to make way for the temple that some Jews want rebuilt. Because the Zionist Third Temple Institute conduct a ceremony every year to lay the first bricks, the first cornerstone of the new Jewish temple, and by implication to begin this process of demolition of the mosque. So we hear from some experts on the conflict tonight. E. Michael Jones, who's written a book called The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, and Israeli-born jazz musician and author of a book on Jewish identity politics. The Wondering Who is the book, and he is Gilad Atzmon. So we asked tonight, what's at the root of what's both a secular and a religious conflict, and can the international community be alerted to the dangers before more Zionists and Arabs die, sucking the rest of us into a wider war? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. At least it was. This week, a look at some of Bristol's hidden Muslim history and an explanation of a gigantic picture of the Delhi Cathedral Mosque at the entrance of Bristol City Museum and Art Gallery at the top of Park Street with Islamic historian Yaqub Zaki. Sorry to say, though, Dialect was suspended from BCFM's schedule last week by the management after a complaint, so you may have to catch this week's show on podcast only at dialectradio.co.uk. So we start this week by looking at the situation over in Jerusalem. It's called Tisha B'Av, Martin, but actually the roots go back a long, long way, don't they?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's one of the three holiest sites in Islam. It's a sacred site to many Jews around the world. And, you know, a bit like the Mosque at Ayodhya in India, it's a point of conflict and potential world war, I suppose.
Why do you say world war?
Well, because unlike India, this is actually at the centre of a region which is a tinderbox for all sorts of other reasons. Don't forget, we've been, you know, invading and killing people over there for a long time now, and the potential for it to escalate remains constantly with us.
The conflict in Syria, of course, is really very close by, isn't it?
It is very close by, and the Israelis have been sticking their finger into it. They've been basically arming, training and providing close air support to Al-Qaeda on the other side of the border there. And it's not just the Israelis doing that. The Western powers and the Saudis have been doing that as well. But they don't seem to be winning, because the other side, the Syrian government side allied with Hezbollah and Iran, seems to be winning. And, of course, the Golan Heights itself is occupied part of Syria. The population there, the original population, is very hostile to the Israeli occupation. They're mostly Druze. They don't actually agree with Al Qaeda, and in fact, they are you know, being treated as pawns in a much bigger game.
Also, just looking at the news today, Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking the US OK to expel Arab villages. So, I mean, there is this kind of ongoing process where the Israeli government really just seems that they want to get the Arabs out of the way, still.
Well, that's right. You've got to remember that the Israeli state was only recognised in 1948 on the basis that it would exist within certain borders.
And on the basis of a terrorist campaign and a war.
Well, a terrorist campaign, but terrorist campaigns sometimes succeed, and this one succeeded. They were recognised, but they were only recognised to run areas over in the west of the region, in what, around Tel Aviv and so on, where the Jewish community was located. There was always been a Jewish community inside Jerusalem, but they were a minority, and there was Jerusalem, frankly, is not supposed to be part of Israel at all. I'm afraid we're now moving to a situation where if you don't actually obey the rules of the United Nations, the question of whether you should be allowed to exist as an independent state definitely comes onto the agenda. And I think that the right wing in Israel need to ask themselves a serious question. If you keep betting the farm on double or bust, it may be bust, and you may end up with having no state at all. Kashmiris haven't got a state, Catalans haven't got a state, the Welsh haven't got an independent state, the Irish haven't got a unified independent state. Why should Israel be any different if you're not going to play by the rules?
One of the other big conflicts in the region, in fact, we've been seeing, it's actually a brilliant report on ITV News this week about the conflict in Yemen. Martin, how is this related to what's going on in Syria? Because we know that the Saudis and actually the British and the Americans are very much behind what isn't really a war, it's more of a slaughter.
Well, I mean, the perception is that the Houthi-led coalition inside Yemen, and it's not entirely made up of Houthis, are part of some kind of Iranian axis of resistance to Israel, and therefore the new Saudi regime, King Salman, who seems to be an extremely unstable personality, he is basically selling to the Israelis and the Americans the idea that the war in Yemen is part of confronting Iran, which is part of getting rid of Assad, which is part of Israel's...
Well, the Iranians don't want to see the Israelis and the West and the Saudis take over Yemen either, do they?
No, they don't, but the idea that the Iranians are providing massive support to the people inside Yemen is simply wrong. That you've got all sorts of reasons why people inside Yemen are fighting, and obviously others will know more about that than I do. The whole thing is turning into a war led by the Israeli right wing and their allies in the US and Britain and the Saudis, and this could turn into a general war in the Middle East. And of course, at the end of that war, I put it to the Israeli right wing, if anybody's listening, you could end up with nothing, just like the settlers in Algeria, who'd been there 130 years, but at the end of the war in Algeria, they had to pack their bags and go, even though they were all born in Algeria and all the rest of it. And the Israelis need to start asking themselves serious questions about how far they're going to go with their ethnic cleansing policy, because that cuts both ways.
Now, I'm also joined by Dr. Judith Brown, who's a former UN worker over in Yemen. Now, Yemen has been actually hitting the headlines, even though actually it should have been maybe much more over the last couple of years, Judith, over the last few weeks, and not good news, is it?
No, it isn't. I think things are just getting worse for the ordinary people living in Yemen. Not only have we got the famine, which I've talked about before, 20 million people are food insecure and 7 million are in the process of starving to death, the biggest disaster in the world. We've got the largest cholera outbreak probably since records began. There's at least 400,000 infected and about getting on for 2,000 have actually died. And in fact, the numbers are probably much greater than that, because the only numbers that are recorded are those that get to hospital. And as I've told you before, a lot of people can't get to hospital or can't afford to go to hospital, and those cases and deaths are unrecorded. And the war seems to keep going on.
Just to add to that, just today the Guardian is saying only 20% of children in Yemen have actually got enough food to eat as well.
Oh yes, well that certainly, well if you think that the total population is 27 million and 20 million are food insecure and 7 million are starving to death, and the population of children in Yemen is very high. I think that half the population is under 15, so that's a phenomenal number of people. Yeah,
the only people really shipping aid in, which is desperately needed, that is to say food and medical supplies, Martin, seem to be the Russians. This is Press TV reporting. The Russians sending their second humanitarian aid flight to Yemen this week.
Well, one of the most pernicious things about it is that the Saudis are carrying out a blockade of Yemen, in which we are enthusiastic participants. It's one of the worst atrocities going on the planet today. Not only are we not doing anything about it to stop it, we're actually aiding it and supporting it. And, you know, at some point, this is going to be a humanitarian disaster of even bigger proportions than it already is.
Having watched this over the last few years much more closely than most, and also having contacts and friends over there still, Judith, where do you think that the fault lies? I mean, is it just simply the Saudi Arabians, or you know, what? How would you pull this apart, this conflict?
Well, everyone who goes to Yemen says there is no sign or evidence of anything that the Iranians are doing, and there's a lot of evidence of bombing from overhead in most of the parts of the old north of Yemen on an everyday basis. And but there are only two areas where there's really active civil war. Taiz, which has been terrible ever since the beginning of the conflict and is still going on, and there's no nearer to a settlement, and Al Bayt, which is on the border between the old north and south, on the east side of the old north. And those two areas, there's a lot of active warfare, and there's pockets of warfare elsewhere, but not a lot. So most of the damage is actually being caused from overhead. And I'll say, despite the cholera outbreak, Saudi Arabia has bombed at least one water desalination plant in the last couple of weeks, even though the water situation is so critical. So the situation just keeps getting worse and worse.
Well, let's see if we can be joined by Stephen Sizer now. Let's have a go. Hi, Stephen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Good evening. Good. Oh, yes, hi. Now, Stephen, we're talking about Yemen here, but this is a wider context, because this is really what we're talking about tonight. We're not just talking about what's been happening over the last week or so at the Third Temple site or the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. We're also talking about the possibility that this could actually help spark a wider war that's already happening. I just wonder if you could take us through some of the theology, if you want, and the reasons why there is this conflict in Jerusalem. And I think we've seen this week the Israeli government putting in metal detectors, taking those away, putting in cameras, and then finally taking those away as well. So it looks as if maybe we're back to square one, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is back under control of the Arabs.
It's indeed a complex issue. There are a number of factors. I think this is primarily a political conflict. It's a conflict between an exclusive Zionist agenda, which is to turn ostensibly a people without a land into what really are colonizers, turning a land that is full of people into an empty land that they can then take. They want the land without the Palestinians. The conflict is being fueled by religious sentiment, particularly from Western fundamentalists in America and Europe, who believe that the Bible predicts an end time Armageddon scenario, and are firmly convinced that the Jewish people in Israel are on God's side, and God will bless nations such as America and Britain as long as they side with Israel against their enemies. I believe it's a political conflict between an exclusive Zionist agenda and the rightful claims of Palestinians to their own self-determination, be it in one state or two states, 67 borders, or a federation. But it's exacerbated by the religious dimension, and you add to that the historic interest that the West has in oil and dependence on the favor of the Zionist lobby, which is very strong in the States and in Europe, and you have all of the ingredients for a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think it's exacerbated on the Arab side, as you were referring to with your other guests in Yemen. There the conflict is religious, in that it is a conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis. Iran is a Shia community. Yemen is largely. Syria has a large Shia community, Lebanon, and that provides an axis of, if you like, dissent from the dominant Sunni position. And that conflict has been going on for 1,000 years. So that's being played out, and America is taking side of the Saudis and exacerbating it.
This whole idea of Jewish identity, we're going to be hearing a bit about that from Gilad Atzmon in a minute, Stephen, but it does seem as if there is a bit of a confusion about whether it's a kind of racial identity or whether it's a religious identity, and also about whether it actually is religious or is it secular. I mean, what can you pull any of that apart for us?
Well, terms like Israel are increasingly seen as synonymous with Jewish and with Zionist, and it's important to keep the three separate. Israel is a state, secular. Well, it isn't. It should be seen as a secular state, a state for all of its citizens, both Jewish and Palestinian and expat. But it's increasingly being equated with a Jewish state, an exclusive state defined by race, and with a strong political, exclusive political agenda, and being equated with Zionism. The three really need to be kept apart. Not all Israelis are Jews. Not all Jews support Israel, and certainly not all Jews are Zionists. And it's very important that we keep those distinguished. But clearly the Zionist agenda is to fuse the three, equate the three, and that's another reason why we're seeing them broaden the definition of anti-Semitism to include any criticism, legitimate or otherwise, of the practices of the State of Israel.
Now, I know when you first went over there, Stephen, years ago, you were sort of bought into this whole thing of, well, actually, maybe Israel is exactly what God wants. You know, this is fundamentalist idea. But was there ever a kind of moment where the penny dropped for you, where you thought, well, actually, maybe it isn't?
Yes, I was raised on a typical fundamentalist theology driven by the idea that God has a chosen people, the Jews, and the role of the church to support the Jewish people, and particularly the writings of people like Hal Lindsey, Tim LaHaye, the idea that 1948 was the Bible coming true, 67 the capture of Jerusalem was the Bible coming true. Until you've been there, there is a fascination with, and it can become very addictive, the belief that the Bible is coming true in our generation. But when you get out there and you see what the Zionists are doing in the occupied territories and the way that they are treating the Palestinians, it's quite shocking, really. I remember vividly being in a church. We had a Palestinian tour guide. And we had a Zionist tour guide, and our bus driver was a Palestinian. And the Israeli guide said that there's no such thing as a Palestinian. They're Arabs. They can go and live anywhere in Arabia. And we were introduced to the Anglican chaplain, who was a Palestinian. He said, "I'm an Israeli, Arab, Palestinian Christian." So you had on the one side a person denying that they existed, and on the other you said, I'm a Palestinian Christian, Arab, Israeli. And that was when the penny began to drop, and then your eyes are opened. You begin to see that Israel is practicing a form of apartheid in the occupied territories, two separate road systems, two separate education systems, two healthcare systems. Your ID card from birth indicates that you are an Arab or a Jew. And that segregation, the very wall, is called Hafrada in Hebrew. It means separate. And that's what the word apartheid means in Dutch Afrikaans.
Yeah, but I mean, the Israelis will say that this is all necessary for security.
It's total rubbish. The root of the wall is designed to maximize the amount of land that can be incorporated into the State of Israel. Something like 20,000 Arab Palestinians pass through the border between the West Bank and Israel on a daily basis. It's a very porous border, so the wall was not built for security. The wall was built to steal as much land as possible. It's twice the height of the Berlin Wall, and it's twice the length of the actual border between Israel and Palestine. It's designed to take in as much land as possible. It goes through Arab towns. It goes through the middle of Arab villages. It's put about 200,000 West Bank Palestinians on the wrong side of the wall. It was built for security. They wouldn't have done that.
Now, the Jerusalem Post today is reporting that Temple Mount prayers have concluded peacefully. Today, clashes, though, are reported in the West Bank. The situation in the old city of Jerusalem is currently under control. Well, that's actually surely thanks to the Israeli Defense Forces.
It's not under control. You're dealing with an occupation, and we simply see on a daily basis different levels of military force used to suppress the right to self-determination, suppress the free movement, access to healthcare, education, family reunions, the use of live ammunition. I've got a handful of rubber bullets sitting next to me on my desk. They're metal bullets with a thin coating of rubber. The use of that kind of ammunition against civilians is illegal in international law.
I believe, actually, the imam of the Al-Aqsa Mosque was hit by one of them as well last week.
Well, seven Palestinians have been killed in the last 2 weeks alone. Amalek, so 1,000 injured. Today I read a report of 40 rabbis calling upon Zionists to storm the Temple Mount. This is not intended to lead to peace and reconciliation. It's an exclusive claim, and as you were saying earlier in your program, it will lead to further conflict and bloodshed.
Okay, so I guess the $64,000 question, Stephen, is how do we actually try and make sure that is diffused before it sparks off?
Well, as you were describing earlier in the tragedy in the Yemen, the use of bombing and the use of military hardware is not the way to resolve differences between the tribes there, the different religious communities, and it certainly isn't in Israel-Palestine, which is why civic society in the West, Jewish groups as well as Palestinian groups are calling for BDS, boycotts, divestments and sanctions, the use of non-violent resistance to put pressure on Israel and upon companies that support the Israeli occupation, people like Caterpillar, G4S and others, put pressure on them, economic pressure, moral pressure, non-violent resistance. It achieved the end of apartheid in South Africa. It led to the end of the communist era in Eastern Europe. Civil disobedience, I believe, is the best way forward for ending the conflict. But Israel has got to realize that if it wants to be seen as a democracy, it must share those rights, equal rights, with the Palestinians. Either one state where all are of equal, or two states based on the 67 borders. Either way, self-determination and the rights of the Palestinians is not going to go away. But we're convinced that violence is not the way to achieve that.
Well, I hope you can stay with us for just another 5 minutes, because we're going to hear now from the Israeli-born jazz musician Gilad Atzmon, who's made his home here in Britain now. He was also in the Israeli Defence Force, served his time, as of course they have conscription over there, and he has written a book called The Wandering Who, about Jewish identity politics, and he thinks actually that there's a massive taboo around it about Jewishness, and he tries to pull that apart for us now.
I find it very difficult to see freedom fighters, people who are oppressed, as criminals, as long as the Palestinians are treated the way they are treated. They're not even second class or third class. They're 7, 8, or 9 class citizens on their land. I would refuse to see them as criminals. They have the right to struggle to liberate their land and at least to live in equal terms.
Why do the Israeli authorities treat Palestinians like this? I mean, most people would see it as quite a racist way, and many people are talking about it as apartheid, just as bad as in South Africa.
To start with, most people are right to see it as racist, because Israel defines itself as the Jewish state and primarily dedicated to the interests of the Jewish population. We have a very good reason to see it as a racist agenda. Now, let me just clarify it. Jews are not a race. So I don't regard myself as a Jew anymore, but let's say that genetically, blood-wise, some people would see me as a Jew, and they're entitled to do so. Still, there is very little common between myself and, let's say, a Yemenite Jew or a Moroccan Jew. We don't look the same. We have a different skin color and so on and so on. So there is no reason to believe that there is a Jewish continuum. However, Jewish politics is always racist. By the way, not necessarily Jewish religion. You can convert tomorrow into a rabbinical, orthodox, Judaic sect, and some rabbis would see you as an equal member of the community. Not all of them. But so Judaism is not necessarily racially driven or racially oriented, but Jewish politics is always racist. And this is not just Zionism. The anti-Zionists are exactly the same. Assuming that you are not a Jew, Tony, you will never be able to become a chairman of JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace. Why? Because you are not racially qualified. It is slightly either frightening or amusing, but the anti-Zionists are actually more racially oriented than their Zionist foes. Now, you mentioned apartheid. I don't think that Israel is apartheid, and this is very important for me to mention. Apartheid is a racist system of exploitation. Israel doesn't want to exploit the Palestinians. It wants them gone. So Israel is practically an ethnic cleanser. It is engaged in politics that, unfortunately, very similar to Hitlerian, not just Nazi, to Hitlerian politics. And I think that when we talk about Israel as an apartheid, we are consciously misleading. We do the same with colonialism. Colonialism is a very clear exchange between a mother state and a settler state. If Israel is a settler state, and it is a settler state, what is its mother state? There is no Jewish mother state. We are dealing with a very, very unique project. It is quite a unique idea that people come to a place after 2,000 years, allegedly after 2,000 years, and they say, sorry guys, you have to move, we were here before. It is even more unusual that they succeed in such a project, because theoretically speaking, every Italian can come visit your home in Bristol, according to the same ideology, and tell, listen, you have to move. I've been here before. You know, I'm Italians, the Romans. You can make it up. You know, you can think about it yourself. You would laugh if something like that happens to you. But what happened in Palestine is not funny at all, because they succeeded in this project with the support of most European Western nations.
Well, some would say that that Britain is the mother state.
By the way, if Britain was the mother state, yeah, so in 1948 it stopped being the mother state. So again, it's a very unusual model of colonialism, where you change your mothers every too often. And this is why some intellectual, I can think of one, Saeed Alam, he said, if it is a colonialism, it's such a unique colonialism where instead of mother state, we have foster mothers. Yeah, so the mothers are changing all the time. Now, I believe that we like to see it as an apartheid or colonialism, and this is something that happens to us because this is how the Jewish left likes to see it, because it's easier for us to deal with it, because we know what is colonialism, we know what is apartheid, we know that colonialism often lead to a post-colonial era, we can think of a post-apartheid, and I'm sorry to say it, if the diagnosis is totally misleading, we are not going to move to a post-colonial era or post-apartheid. We are dealing with a very unique project in history, a project with no precedence. And the only way to deal or understand this project is to understand Jewish culture.
Well, that's what Gilad Atzmon is trying to do with his book. But Stephen, he's making some pretty shocking accusations there, in a way, saying that actually apartheid is not a good enough word for this, because there is no apparently no ability or wish to really compromise with the Arab population and the Palestinian population, that he's saying there that they just want them out.
Yes, I think Gilad is right on what the ultimate agenda is. But it's also true that along the way, the Israeli state is exploiting the Palestinians for cheap labor in the settlements and to some extent in Israel. I still think that there is value in using the concept of apartheid. Frankly, I think it's much worse than it was in South Africa, because there were no walls in South Africa. Yes, there were townships, and to some extent what Israel has done in corralling the Palestinians into centers of population, Nablus, Jenin, Ramallah, and so on, Bethlehem, behind the wall, they are kind of a cross between the Bantustans and the Indian reservations in North America, and they are shrinking, and progressively Israel is annexing more and more of those territories. I mean, the Jordan Valley, for example, has largely been annexed. It's not possible for Palestinians to travel through the Jordan Valley now. I think there are two roads in and out of Jericho, which Palestinians can use. It's surrounded by a 6 foot deep, 6 foot wide ditch, rather than a wall. But I think there is still value in certainly to help Westerners, if not Palestinians, understand the concept of ethnic cleansing and racial segregation, which we're seeing in Israel. So I would still want to be able to use the term apartheid. Certainly it annoys the Zionists when we do, because they don't want to be equated with the failed policies of the South Africans.
What about your experience, Stephen, of the Zionist lobby here in Britain? I mean, because that seems to have affected you in last year, being told that you had to stop talking about the Middle East and stop using social media.
Well, that was an agreement I made with my bishop. It was voluntary on my part. I didn't have to, but I chose to, because Anglican clergy are free to express their opinion on apart from join the National Front. Anglican clergy can express whatever views they wish politically or theologically, and the ecclesiastical authorities have no power over us in that regard. So it was a voluntary decision I made to obey my bishop and to desist from commenting on Middle East issues and traveling there and so on, or resign. And I chose in the end to retire early so that I could appear on programs such as this and continue my work in advocacy and justice, peace and reconciliation in the Middle East.
And so what about the wider Zionist lobby in Britain? What have you, do you know about that?
I know a great deal about that. I've written a book on it, which hasn't been published yet, on the Israel lobby in the UK. I've experienced their game plan, their strategy, as people like Gilad and others have. It follows there is a Hasbro manual that tells Zionists how to defend Israel. In my experience, it follows four levels or four strategies. The first is to ingratiate themselves, try and get you to join them in their Zionist views. If that doesn't work, they will try and intimidate you, bombard you with letters, emails. I was attacked anonymously for years. They're trying to intimidate you, to silence you. If that doesn't work, they move on to intimidate others, to try and isolate you, and they will intimidate others so that you have events cancelled, speaking engagements turned down, and they target your friends, target your colleagues, to try and isolate you. If that doesn't work, then they will try and incriminate you with Holocaust denial, with anti-Semitism, with racism, whatever. I've had the police turn up several times as a result of complaints, I've dealt with them appropriately, and I've never, those allegations have never been justified.
I'm just wondering, what sort of allegations have been made against you? I mean, surely, you know, you're writing books on this subject, you're preaching, at least you were up until a while ago, on the Middle East. What sort of possible slur could there be on what you're doing? I mean, because it seems that there's lots and lots of information available about what's going on in Israel in the mainstream press anyway.
It has to do with something we spoke about earlier, which was the broadening of the definition of anti-Semitism. Attempts have been made in Parliament and in universities and in law to redefine anti-Semitism from the legitimate historic definition, which is hatred of Jews or prejudice toward Jewish people, which I would repudiate and abhor, to include criticism of Israel, since Israel is a Jewish state. If you criticize Israel, you're criticizing Jewish people, therefore it's anti-Semitism. And I, like many, reject that revision of the definition. And I think it's important that we are able to express our views on human rights issues, irrespective of the race or religion of the perpetrators.
Can you just remind us of the books you have written and maybe when you're going to get this next book published, Stephen?
Well, I had two books published, Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon, which was my PhD thesis, looking at the historical roots, theological basis and political consequences of Christian Zionism. And then the second book was a lighter, more popular book called Zion's Christian Soldiers, The Bible, Israel and the Church. And it's a look at how the Bible's been misquoted, misused to defend a Zionist agenda. And I deconstruct that and show how to read the Bible in a way that shows that God's intention has always been that the land should be shared and that Jerusalem should be an inclusive city and his holy places are there for all nations. Whether my book on the Israel lobby gets published is another matter. We'll see.
Well, I hope you do. I hope it does. Anyway, thanks ever so much for joining us, Stephen.
Pleasure.
Again.
Thank you.
Now, let's just go back to you, Judith. I don't know if you mind commenting on this. How do you think, if at all, what's been going on over in Israel and in Syria, which is obviously right next door, has influenced and affected what's happened in Yemen, the country you lived in for quite a while?
Well, it's been quite interesting, the links between Israel and Saudi Arabia in this war, because there's been a lot of political meetings and photographs and of important people, like, for example, Prince Walid visiting Israel. And there's been suggestions that, for example, when the Saudis left their embassy in Yemen, there was Israeli weapons inside, and there are Israeli weapons being supplied to certain militias, particularly ISLA, in the current conflict. So there has been links, but not only that, but you can actually see that the strategies are the same. This sort of like isolation, not sort of like tying Yemenis into a certain area so that they can't escape, and then sort of like bombing them. The difference, I suppose, is that because the world tends to look at what's happening in Israel and Palestine, and if there are any conflicts, they tend to be fairly high up the media agenda. The difference in Yemen is that it hasn't been on the media agenda, and therefore Saudi Arabia has actually had a freer hand to execute the sort of policies that Saudi Arabia has been much freer than Israel in mass carpet bombing of people and destroying homes on a much, much vaster scale, even in terms of the proportion. But so there has been a lot of links, a lot of similarities in the tactics, and I suppose that another thing that happens and has been reported and on quite extensively, there's a report by Peter Salisbury out in the near future from Chatham House, talking about the way that certain people at the head of militias and the head of armies and whatever are making sort of masses and masses of money on the Yemen war. So these are the people who are being brought to the table to negotiate, and they're the people who are actually personally gaining, even if their country and Yemen is an ordinary Yemeni people are suffering. And I think that happens too in Israel and Palestine. There are certain people who even Palestinians who meet the Israeli agenda, and their lives are sort of like quite comfortable. So you can see that there there are links, and it makes it much more difficult to negotiate for peace. So yes, there are similarities in terms of the way that the split in Israel and Palestine is quite clear between Jews and non-Jews. It's not at all the same. It doesn't have the same clarity in Yemen, because there is the is anti-Houthi and groups, and then the rest. The rest aren't necessarily pro-Houthi. Far from it. Most people in Yemen want to be ruled in a democratic system, not by a militia. But nonetheless, the actual numbers of people that are starving to death are in the old North Yemen, which is a mixed race of Sunni and Shia. The percentage of Shia the Zaidi tends to vary from estimate to estimate, but it's somewhere maybe around 30%. So of the 20 million in the north of Yemen that are starving, only probably less than half of those are Shia, and both the Shia and the Sunni are actually suffering equally.
Is there anything, do you think, can be done in Yemen, Judith, looking at the situation? Because it looks as if there simply is too much money being made by British arms companies, etc., and the pressure is on there from the US internationally to virtually wipe out the Yemeni people. Is there anything you think that is a prospect to stop this slaughter?
Well, it's extremely problematical, and of course it's been made more problematical by the strange things that are happening with Qatar recently. Initially, this appeared to be a disagreement between Qatar and UAE, maybe over political differences that they had in Egypt and Libya, because they both take opposite views in those two countries. It also might be something to do with the political differences in Saudi Arabia, because Mohammed bin Nayef, who was recently deprived of his post of Crown Prince, and a new Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was appointed. Mohammed bin Nayef, he was very strongly pro-Qatar, and Prince Salman, who wanted to take over, may have wanted to change his policies. So there's lots of
I mean, it's also the suggestion that a lot of that was to do with Al Jazeera, because a lot of the stuff coming out of Al Jazeera is both pro-Palestinian and has actually been a bit more sympathetic to the rebels in against Saudi Arabia, for example, in Yemen.
Yeah, again, some of the reports are against Saudi Arabia, but actually when you looked at them on the whole, and I was looking at that media regularly, it wasn't that strongly against Saudi Arabia. It did show some atrocities, but it always presented the Saudi view as rational. There was, just before the split with Qatar, there was there was some torture some alleged torture in Yemeni prisons by UAE forces, and Al Jazeera did show that, and that was immediately beforehand. But overall, that was a relatively small thing to have provoked such a big crisis, especially as in Yemen itself, the only troops on the ground that weren't mercenaries were actually from Qatar, so it seemed sort of like amazing. And the other strange thing was that the day before the split with Qatar, there was actually a lot of fighting in Aden, particularly around the airport area, between forces that were paid by Saudi Arabia that were loyal to Hadi and the forces of the United Arab Emirates. So whereas, and the differences between Saudi Arabia and UAE in Yemen have been catalogued over a long period of time. It have been reported reported, certainly in the Iranian media and more recently in Western mainstream media. So that had been reported, and only the day before there were fights in Aden between, if you like, Saudi Arabia supported people and UAE supported people. And then out of the blue, Qatar, that had been strongly on the side of Saudi Arabia, we were suddenly told that they were that the ogres and the ones that were supporting terrorism. It's been a very, very strange turn of affairs. And of course, that's the uncertainty in Qatar means that it's very difficult for it's more difficult to get an agreement in Yemen.
Martin, Judy's talking about mercenaries there. There's lots and lots of mercenaries in that part of the world. Some of them recruited from Libya, elsewhere. One of the things I keep hearing as well, maybe not, this is not going out on the mainstream press a lot, is just that how much money is being paid to people from where there isn't really a lot of ideology involved in a lot of these rebel groups, particularly in Syria. A lot of it is just simply to do with who is paying more than the other guys. And of course, well, we had a report a few weeks ago from Scott Bennett where he revealed that actually quite a lot of the money, he's the US former US Army psychological warfare officer, plus a Senate report was saying that there was quite a lot of money which was funding the mercenaries in Syria and elsewhere, which is actually coming from the Gulf states and some of it from the Americans, but coming through Switzerland, which is what makes me a little bit suspicious, I suppose, about Theresa May and her little holiday that she's having at the moment over in Switzerland, which seems to be the main money channel. Of course, Switzerland was the main money channel for Hitler for the building up of the armed forces before World War II, and also for providing masses of foreign exchange and finance during World War II to the Nazis. So the Swiss may be the sort of players behind the scenes making sure that these mercenary armies can continue to fight. And it doesn't really matter what the ideology is, they're just driven by money.
Well, Switzerland has always had they've got very big washing machines in Switzerland where they wash all the dirty money for the world. So it's not surprising that everybody finances their stuff through Switzerland. They are effectively mercenaries, it's true. I mean, at one stage, the Saudis cleared out their prisons. They went round all their high security prisons and said, look, you want to do another 25 years in prison, or do you want to go and fight in Saudi in Syria, and we will pay you a salary and et cetera, et cetera. There's recent information that's come out that NATO was bringing stuff in via Azerbaijan, mostly weapons from the Balkans, from Bulgaria. The Bulgarian press have been following this up. And what the West does, because they're trying, you know, they've created a whole industry, a military industry, which is not accountable to the democratically elected authorities, and that allows them to do all sorts of things.
We're going
to
hear a final clip from Gilad Atzmon now, and this is his theory, right or wrong, about why peace in Jerusalem, particularly. Seems to be evasive, seems to be almost impossible to get because of the words, the actual Hebrew words for peace.
The notion of peace, I mean peace, harmony, reconciliation, loving your neighbor, doesn't even exist in the Hebrew language. The word shalom doesn't mean peace as we understand it in English. The word shalom means security for the Jews. And you probably notice that when every time the Israelis talk about shalom, they basically talk about security. Shalom, for shalom to be peace, we need to see a metamorphic shift in the Jewish society. And this can happen. But when this happens, Israel won't be the Jewish state anymore. So I'm talking about a spiritual change. You have to understand, people talk about one state, two states. Some people even talk about two Jewish states because, you know, the West Bank is now where, you know, they want it to be a Jewish state with all the settlements and so on and so on. But the facts on the ground are quite simple. Israel Palestine are one state, one electric grid, one sewage system, one pre-dial area code. It is just one state that is currently dominated by a moronic, racist, supremacist ideology. And the first thing that we could do is just to call a spade a spade, to point at it, so those people who are engaged in these policies or subscribe to these ideologies at least know that we see it, we are unhappy with it, and this may lead towards a change.
Well, let's hope so. This is the last word there to Gilad Atzmon, a jazz musician born in Israel, served in the Israeli army, now living here in Britain. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests on the first hour, Labour Party councillor for Eastern, Ruth Pickersgill, and also leader of the Lib Dems, Gary Hopkins. Also to former UN Yemen worker, Judith Brown, and Christian Zionism author and Reverend Stephen Sizer. Not to forget old Dave Brooksford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects, currently suspended from BCFM, the Tuesday noon slot, hopefully back soon, but you can catch it online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. This show's story links and comment page is onewordthisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s there or listen in the car. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10 and The Real Musical Deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 1994 and Tony Rebel. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Let us get active. Come on, say another time, if you always think positive and think, man. Sin, oh, Lord have mercy. And this is something me come here to tell everyone. Wow. Say that a good sense in me, yeah, it used to run this land. But since the other day, say them a deal with substitution. Shan. And now the crack and cocaine, we a bring pure destruction. Shan. That's why this morning me get up and me write three letters, cause me say I wanna address not to the prime minister. Me say the next one address to the security minister. Me never done the one to the commissioner. Me cause them a hypocrite and confounder, cause how the hell them a go fight against sensimania. And I hit a put poor people pot on fire. Down we used to plant it nothing a Jamaica, and them burn it down with no police and soldier. And them a import the coffee mash up with you.
Live from the Sky News Centre.